Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Nollies podcast. I'm your host, James Ennard, joined by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Rowan is on the sound and the cameras and all that jazz. Say hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
And our guest today is a Mayfield lady called Maureen Considine.
Yep.
You're very welcome to the Two Nollies podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Once before we get into it, we've got two guests in the studio as well. Say hi, Sarah and Simon.
Hello.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Sarah brought us up some baked goods last week, and she was meant to bring them to the studio, but Timmy had COVID, so she actually brought them up to the door.
Yeah, fair play. Thank you.
Even though Timmy has no taste, he still had them.
So. Do you know what? They actually got me thinking. Do you know when I go on for a sweet treat, a bar of chocolate, a Mars bar, a Snickers, whatever, instead of having them, buy a stack of them, the protein balls and them other things, and having them in the house.
I know.
And you're having a treat, but it's also full of protein and vitamins and whatever else. So that's what I'll be doing in the future. So I'll get your phone number after, and I'll buy a monthly supply.
She's called The Balanced Baker on Instagram. Yeah. But you know what I found about the treats, and this is pure off the cuff now, like, but it's a nice pitch for you anyway. But do you know the box of treats? And I have an awful sweet tooth, especially after my dinner or after the gym or something like that. But if you had one of the protein balls or one of the homemade Snicker bars, whatever, that do you. Yeah. Whereas, no, if you want a packet of biscuits or a packet of Rocky Bells, you'd eat the packet, but with these, you wouldn't.
Jesus Christ, yeah. So, be gone.
You can have that one, right? So, thanks for the treats and thanks for coming. So, Maureen, what's the crack with you, girl? For the people that don't know you, do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from?
Okay. I'm from Mayfield. I grew up in Shannon until I was about 11, and then we were one of the few families selected for the first regeneration scheme in the country, Ard Valley.
What year is this now?
Around 1991 to 1993. I think that's, you know, it was a building programme. But like, they made you do pre-tenancy kind of Garda vetting and stuff like that, and courses and different things. But yeah, we were in the first regeneration scheme in the country before it was even a buzzword.
Shannon Lawn was regenerated and you moved to Ard Valley.
No, so Mount Erne was being regenerated into Ard Valley. They gave it a new name and everything. So they would have been the flats, you know, like the flats in the glen that they knocked down in the last few years. Same thing, but they refurbished them in brick and they filled in all the gaps with houses. So ours was one of the houses in building in the gaps.
Yeah.
And I was 12 or 13, but I ended up writing my degree thesis on social housing and my MA thesis on regeneration and social housing.
Can I ask you about housing and that in Mayfield?
Yeah.
So we're obviously from Knocknaheeny and Halley Hill. We're undergoing a big regeneration at the moment, and the place looks completely different to what it used to 10, 12 years ago, especially during the 90s. When I walk through parts of Mayfield, there's parts of Mayfield kind of affluent, you could say. Definitely middle class. There's parts of it has mixed housing between social and private, but there's other parts of Mayfield that look like Knocknaheeny in the 90s. It looked like they've just been left out, and I won't name them because I don't want to be stigmatising any areas. Which you might know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But there's savage poverty and neglect in that in parts of Mayfield. So how come, and you might have come this across this, how come parts of it was regenerated and other parts was just left?
So They were the only social housing flats in Mayfield, and they were targeted because they were flats. And I think, you know, buzzwords like antisocial behaviour and stuff like that. I remember living in Shannonlaw and looking up the hill to Mount Erin, and my mother was after telling us that we'd be moving there. And it was like the place with all the fires. Really freaked out. Like, why are we moving to the place that every time I look up the hill, there's a fire? Like, and it was just run down. You know, that happens sometimes in housing where people keep moving out. So if someone was living in a flat in Mayfield, they might have room for one or two children. Eventually they'd get a house when they had more children. So the population kept changing. So when they regenerated it, they tried to include a mix of housing and flats. So the flats are two bed, but the houses are one, two, three and four bed. So they were trying to accommodate all different types of families and kind of keep a sense of community in the area. Why that's the only reason they picked it is because it's the only area with flats.
The whole area wasn't regenerated. So like in Knocknaheeny, it's all regenerated houses, everything, bungalows, everything has been flattened and there's no houses being built. But in Mayfield, which is just targeted the flat complexes.
Yeah.
So then those estates that had houses weren't regenerated.
No, they were bricked up. I don't know if you had the bricking up scheme, but so everything was prefabbed and then they went along and they kind of went over everything in bricks to improve the insulation and all that sort of stuff. But I remember waiting for the bricking up. And our breaking up happened about 2 years before we moved anyway. But was all they did. They bricked up.
But you know, because the stigma Knocknaheeny has, because Knocknaheeny has a reputation, okay? But I think maybe that works to its advantage in terms of the investment into the area. Mm-hmm. But there's parts of Mayfield that could really do with the investment, but it doesn't have the name like a Knocknaheeny, but it has all the same problems, if not worse. And it's just something that I found, you know, curious about, like, you know, did Knocknaheeny get all this investment because it has a stigma and maybe Mayfield doesn't have that name, but it still has all this neglect and poverty and social issues, you know?
Well, I remember when they did the Knocknaheeny master plan, which they made this decision to regenerate Knocknaheeny. I was writing one of those theses and they kind of decided that they'd done the work in Mayfield and it was to move on to the next place. And in some ways they had, but if you don't stay on top of it, if you don't keep providing things that a community needs, you know, like Ballymun's a great example. They shipped a lot of people out there in the 70s when there were no shops. So you couldn't get your messages. So then everyone had to get into town to get their messages and there wasn't a bus service. So it created a lot of problems that could have been solved by a shopping centre, you know? And Mayfield had the same problem, no shopping centre.
Even in Knocknaheeny for the regeneration, and we'll move on from the regeneration after this, but even in Knocknaheeny for the regeneration, there's been people in Knocknaheeny for years, since the late 70s, and then their houses were being demolished and they were moved to areas like the Meadows between Knocknaheeny and Farnley up by the water tower. So it's a huge area, but no nothing in there, no bus service, no shops. Or else down in Shanachiel, no bus service, no shops. What about the old ladies that have no cars? How do they go to the shop? Like, how do they go to the post office? How do they pay? The isolation that, no, and it's just like, we're regenerating it and you're going down and that's the end of it. You know what I mean?
It's like, there's not much thought going into the planning, really, of it. Are the people that, it's the people that are going to be living there should be the ones really asked what they need. You know, you were right there. There's no bus service going down into Shanachiel, none whatsoever. Like, and
we're from Knocknaheeny all our lives, right? If we were in the Meadows, you'd want Google Maps to get your way around it. If you went into the Meadows in the car and threw me out down the end of it, I wouldn't be able to get out. I'd have to go through the field. I'd be quicker to go through the field. It's just so vast. There's so many houses down there. There's nothing down there.
So there's two things happening. Is the designer's ego is one. So the architects, they'd be cursing me, but they've been criticised about this for decades, if not centuries. Their ego can get in the way, so they have a master plan. It doesn't matter that you have to live under their master plan, they have a master plan and they have a vision and they're encouraged in their training to really stand up for their vision, whatever their vision may be. And then the other side of it is the social side of it. So gentrification is a word we use when they decide they're going to clean up an area by making it more middle class. So they did it. They very much did it in Ballymun. Ballymun went from 100% working and underclass population to 60% middle class, 60% private housing during that regeneration. And that was by design. So by renovating your house and suggesting we found another house for you and, you know, different things like that. There's an element of social planning or social control, depending on your opinion about who they're selecting and where they're putting them. So like I said, we had to go through tenancy pre-selection. And I found the criteria for it one day. And they describe what types of families they wanted and what types of heads of household they wanted. And I think my mother was an exception because they did want male heads of household. They wanted two parent families. I think my mother was an exception, but she was on the board at a local youth training workshop and a few other things, you know. But we were pre-selected, and the next phase was pre-selected, and the final phase was pre-selected. But then after that, once people moved out, there was no selection. There was no vetting anymore. And I'm not sure I agree with that anyway, but they created a community and then they just kind of left. And we were supposed to have estate management as part of it, which would empower local people to, it's just basic stuff, have a small budget for cutting the grass, painting the railings, you know, cleaning the windows and other features in very high buildings where people couldn't get up to them and stuff, changing the light bulbs in the corridors of the flats because we couldn't reach them. I remember a city council guy told me it was one of the worst things about dealing with social housing tenants. They expect you to change a light bulb. And then me explaining to him, we don't own commercial ladders, you know, to get up a three-story building to change a light bulb. We don't own them. Nobody owns them. So we were supposed to have a budget. And at the 11th hour, the city council redrafted that budget to say you can have it, but we've total control over it. So the whole thing collapsed. People were so offended after all the work they'd done. The whole thing collapsed. So, you know, there's things to watch out for, but there are a lot of people in criticism.
You know your stuff.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, I bore you to death with it.
No, it's not boring. No, you should be inside the city hall. I'd say behind fucking Lord Mayor's.
I'm not sure they'd have
next
me.
Next to the Lord Mayor anyway. Tell them.
But there are things communities need to watch out for. And definitely gentrification. If they're trying to change the makeup of your community, that's one. And the other one would be if do you trust us to look after our own community or not? Because it's a problem when they don't, you know, it really is. Because the best people leave, don't they? Yeah. You know, they get sick of it. They get sick of the antisocial problems and they'll go live somewhere else.
But isn't the path of social mobility, like you grow up in a tough area and you go through education, get a job, and part of it is kind of moving into a nicer house, into a nicer area that doesn't have the social problems you grew up with. That's neither good nor bad. It's just
it is. No, and I mean I don't live in Mayfield anymore either. But I did notice a lot of people who were really trying. They were like community activists, and then they were gone. And I kind of asked my mother, "Where's so and so gone?" And I was they got fed up, you know. Like I knew people as well who were targeted. The wrong house was targeted with a petrol bomb, so they left in fear. You know,
how could you blame somebody?
Yeah.
Do you know where I'm living at the moment? My house has been. The windows have been blown in twice in the last couple of years. The wheelie bin has been blown 2-3 times. But you know what I think? I did that a lot of times when I was younger.
Yeah, but I was so sick of the wheelie bin robbing.
Back on me now, you know what I mean? Yeah. But like, I'm a proud nanny, but believe me, when I get the money, I'm gone. But I'm going to stay on the north side, but I'm just going a bit outside it.
Yeah.
Into the country, but 5 minutes from home type of things, you know?
I'm in Racoonie, so. Yeah. And I love it. And when I look out my window, I don't see other brick walls, you know? Yeah. And that means a lot. I think the closeness of our houses really got to me. I think it made me claustrophobic. And now I'm just like, I feel like I can breathe. I open the back door.
So do you know when you were going through college, were you working?
Yeah. Bar work and restaurant and shop work, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And when did you complete your master's?
2008, 2009.
Yeah. And did you get work out of it, or was this just a labour of love?
No, it was more of a labour of love. I didn't know how to get work out of it. I didn't know how to be an art historian. I'm still trying to figure it out. I didn't know how to be a working class art historian anyway.
So you did your bachelor's, master's and the social housing?
So my bachelor degree was fine art, but you have to do an academic thesis as well. And our colleges are so liberal that I said, I'd like to write about social housing design. And they were like, yeah, go on, go for it.
It's interesting. Well,
that's interesting. That
just let me
that.
Do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, yeah. Social housing design is, it sounds like architect's office, something like that. Do you know?
Yeah. Well, you could bring in your own theories. So you could bring in like class theories up from Karl Marx and feminist theories. And so some of mine was a massive rant about how it was middle class men designing for predominantly working class women and their children.
Mm.
And like about 8 pages of me giving out about that.
So you're doing a PhD now?
Yeah.
And is that around the same team or is it completely...
It's a little bit connected because it's on the institutions, the residential institutions and memory from them. But also, what do we do with that memory?
Residential institutions like the laundries and stuff like that.
The laundries, the industrial schools, mother and baby homes, and to a lesser extent, what were called then the mental hospitals or the mental asylums.
That must have been really tough, like going into the history of all those places, like and reading some of the stories that were really horrific and sad.
Well, we're from in Hollyhill. Just below Hollyhill is Shanachie and then the hospital, you know, and we would have spent a lot of time down there taking drugs and going through it to get to the Shaky Bridge and
robbing the copper.
Robbing the copper and that stuff. But
to buy the drugs.
We used to be down there as well, buzzing over our heads on knees in the middle of the night, afraid of our lives to walk down the corridor to go for the piss.
Should be.
But long story short, anyway, when you're in the building, you can feel the energy in there and you know bad things happened in here.
My parents worked there.
Yeah.
But, and they told me about some of the bad things happened there, definitely. Yeah.
What building did they work in? The grey building and the
grey building, And like my mother, because it was the 70s, when she got married, she had to give up her job because they couldn't both be civil servants. Yeah. So
I know, I'm mad.
I've been to the basement of that building.
Yeah.
Right. And
what are you doing down there, Tim?
I'm probably just on. Do you know when you're on your walk, he's there. Do you know?
I know.
You know what the fuck you're up to. But anyhow, I see the padded cells, rooms in the basement, like, and you know, just walking around the place, like, and I wouldn't have known much about anything at that stage, but it really, really, really was a scary place. Mm. But it wasn't until years down the line I seen a few different documentaries about places like that. And I was saying, holy fuck. Because there were some people that went in there were saying.
Yeah, my mother said that.
They were actually saying there was nothing wrong with them, but there were family members. Say, for instance, this is an example. There was this one farming couple, both of them died. They had a son and daughter. Both of them left, right? The farm was the son was looking after the farm and the daughter and the house, whatever, but she got involved with a guy and he was a guard. And they managed to get the brother, who's the farmer, into a mental institution, telling the Lord, like he was a guard, you can imagine the power they had back then.
Yeah.
And they got him in.
Yeah.
You know, and there was absolutely nothing wrong with this man, but he ended up going mad in the end. He lost his mind. It was a documentary on TV, can't hear about it. But I like I said, there's a lot of stories like that.
Do you know if you're in there as well? You can climb up the top in the red building and shake the bell.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
But when you're walking through the corridors and you're looking in they look like cells, like some of the room, and then some of them have concrete slabs on them. But you just think of the stories in there. And a lot of people in addiction would have been sent in there because like how the government reacted to drug use and addiction back in the day was a health-led approach, but it was house them in asylums. That was the response. Mm-hmm. So you could have somebody that might be perfectly normal, and maybe the alcohol or the drug use was probably a very understandable reaction to the experiences they've had as a child, but they could be housed in an asylum as somebody with a mental illness for the rest of their days. And eventually they probably will end up losing it or being so heavily medicated that they just develop psychological issues, you know, as a result. But it's just sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my mother said exactly that the people went insane and became traumatized. And then that's what they were dealing with, their trauma. And then their trauma became more serious trauma and eventually PTSD. And they're living in it and experiencing it. So she said that was one host of people. She said there were other people who were really criminally insane, but again the sane people had to be around them and that was damaging to them, you know. And she said that there was an awful lot of people put in by their families for being gay, something like the farm situation. that would happen. Sometimes, and this one I have to laugh at, as a woman, sometimes you have to deflect by laughing, but being too intelligent as a woman or being a difficult woman, they definitely would have locked me up.
Did it burn you as a witch long
ago? Oh, stop it. Burnt at the stake. Yeah. I wouldn't have lasted it in Magdalen Andre at all. They would have put me into the mental asylum for not doing what I was told. Mm. So, yeah.
Drawn parts of rural Africa.
Yeah.
They still burn witches.
Yeah.
So, old, tend to be old ladies that are still alive in the tribe, and a rumor can go around, and before you know it, they're burnt alive. So, like, we might think that we're a million years away and all that, but we're actually not. Like, we can look at Africa and think, look, they're savages. We did the same thing ourselves maybe 100 years before, or a couple of hundred years in the medieval times at least.
Yeah.
And there's something you said there as well around housing or containing, you know, seriously or criminals. Mm-hmm. In with innocent people. Mm-hmm. Do you know, we did the tour of Spike Island. Mm-hmm. Did you ever do the tour of Spike Island? No. You should do it anyway, it's very good. Mm-hmm. But they talk about, like, Spike Island was like a holding prison before, in Cromwell would ship them to Australia, the Caribbean, United States. But it could be children down there for robbing oranges, and it could be paedophiles and rapists, and they're all thrown into the same ship.
Yeah.
So you have to wonder, like, what's happening to the women and the children on the ships at the hands of, you know.
Well, that's another thing, and I suppose quick trigger warning to anyone out there for rape. We know of women who were made pregnant in the mental asylum, who were transferred to Besbra and then sent back to the mental asylum. And we know of cases where, we know of a case of a mixed race child, and I wouldn't normally say mixed race, but it's just by way of explanation.
Yeah.
And the only person in the asylum who was a person of colour was a Dominican priest. Mm. So the Dominican priest raped this woman and they sent her off to Besbra. She gave birth. Her son was sent to an industrial school. She was sent back to the mental asylum. And in the industrial school, his older brother met him. The nun called him over and said, "This is your brother." And he didn't understand. Like, didn't understand anything about who his family were. And then they took that boy to scrub the dirt off him because of the colour of his skin.
That's unreal, isn't it?
Yeah. So all those traumas are connected across all those institutions.
Totally. Speaking of Besbra, so it was Catherine Coffey O'Brien who actually put me in touch with yourself. She's you're both friends.
Yeah.
Catherine Coffey O'Brien obviously was on our podcast, and she's a powerhouse of a woman come through the mother and baby homes herself as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And has a family history related to all that. And she says that without you, she wouldn't have been able to do what she's doing in terms of advocacy and all that stuff. So say hi to Catherine.
And likewise.
Yeah, Catherine's great.
Obviously.
Yeah. How did you end up getting involved in activism around the mother and baby homes?
It was through feminism. And so I started exploring my feminism and what it meant. And
what does that look like? Like, how does one?
Well, that's the thing. There's many feminisms, so people have the worst stereotype often in their head about.
My dad used to say it. My mum was a feminist, right? My dad used to call, you know, she's going out to her groups, the anti-man club. He did worries, you know.
But my husband takes the piss as well, but I think I've turned him into a feminist, because sometimes he comes home from work with a story and I'll be just like holding in the laughter because I know I made him that way. There are just many different types of feminism. Yeah. And I was a bit frustrated with some of the feminism I was encountering because it didn't affect poor or marginalised women's lives at all. And it seemed all to be about getting into the boardroom or, you know, Sheryl Sandberg feminism.
Did this all come along because of your own experiences being treated negatively by men and organisations?
I don't think it was particularly men. See, that's another thing. Like, for me, feminism is about understanding that we have a society that it treats women less well than men on a generalized basis. Mm. And women do it too. You know, sorry, everyone, but women do it too. Like, the nuns did it to all of the women in the mother and baby homes and Magdalen laundries and industrial schools. So it's more about a system of society that's set up that to put male needs before female needs. So even the law, for example, like, well, you'll know of cases of domestic violence where women have gone to court to try and get a barring order, and they'll get the barring order, but he still gets to see the kids, and maybe he should still get to see the kids, but it's very traumatizing for the kids who've witnessed the assault. And then the social workers get involved, and the social workers often blame the victim for being a victim. You're exposing your children to violence.
Mm. I think
there's huge tension there.
Yeah, even relationships like that, when it's a man and woman and they're tit for tat, I think the kids are also being used as a little weapon as well in between, and
they can be leveraged in both directions too. Especially if the parents aren't mature enough not to do that. Yeah.
But even in addiction and crime, which is what we tend to talk about here for most of the time if a couple has a child and both are in addiction, if the man leaves the home, it's kind of nearly, oh, he's in addiction. It's kind of, you know, it's okay, or it's not as bad. The woman leaves the home, if the woman leaves the child or the child's in together, you want the stigma that's directed at that woman.
Mm.
Yeah.
If the man goes to prison, the woman will, in general terms now, like, the woman will go up with the kids swinging off or passing in the runners, the money for the tobacco and everything. When the woman goes to prison, she's on her own.
Yeah.
And she's expected to be engaging with social workers and have all that responsibility when she comes out. So there's loads of, like, we talk about intersectionality here before as well, like, things that are bad for men, if the same circumstances exist for a woman, they're worse for a woman. Yeah. Because woman, it's like, know your privilege, like, when if you're a white, you know, if you're a white male in Western Europe, you're privileged, you're more privileged than a white female.
Yeah.
And if you're a white female traveller, it's once again.
Absolutely.
And so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, you pile on things like being a traveller or
gay.
Yeah, anything like that. And it does get worse. But also then I've noticed a class thing. So a working class guy can be treated as definitely significantly more badly than, say, a middle class woman. It'll depend on the situation and how slippery the situation is. Mm. But it's just recognizing a system. So it's not men or any man in particular who hurt me or anything like that. It's really recognizing a system. And I always very skeptical child. Like, I spotted the hypocrisy everywhere I saw it. And I was annoying. You know, I was that child who kept asking the parents difficult questions.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that happening? Why is it like that? Why did the Berlin Wall exist was one of my best questions ever when it was coming down on the TV. I demanded to know the full history of the Berlin Wall. My mother had to make up half of it on the spot. And that was the kind of stuff I did. So, no, it was very much recognising a system. And when I got involved with the laundries, first it was with the laundries, it was because they all lived, like, I, as far as I could see, lots of survivors lived in Mayfield. And they lived in situations that weren't right. And then we were talking about it, you know, the McAleese report was happening, and we were talking about how we're going to make this right. And when the McAleese report came out, I remember getting the paper and reading it and just realizing it was a whitewash, because all of us know if somebody was taken to a laundry, they weren't seen again. So this idea that women did on average a year and a half, I think that was what the McAleese report said. Mm. That's not true. Most of them died in there, you know. And that's borne out in the research I started doing. I found a lot of the dead, and they did die in there. The Good Shepherds alone have buried 300 people, and girls and women in their time period here in Cork, about 100-year period.
There's Good Shepherds up by us, actually, up by the old woman's jail, you know, by Shanachiel.
Yeah, and that's the one.
There was a burnt down there a few years ago and asbestos and all these things, but years ago, like, your mum would be threatening you, like, if you don't behave now, you'll be going down to the Good Shepherds, isn't it?
But the Good Shepherds, was that for kids?
There was an industrial school that later, like, they called it an orphanage, but I don't call it an orphanage because an orphan is someone's parents.
Was there an age limit on the kids to stay there? Because, like you said, there's about 300 people died in there. Like, did a lot of them grow into their 30s and 40s and 50s
When the laundries were originally set up, for fallen women in the 19th century, and fallen meant like prostitutes and stuff like that. And they came from an English system where they were trying it was called rescue work, and the idea was teach them a skill, sewing or, you know, sewing or cleaning or something, so they'd have an alternative job. But they never really worked out like that, obviously. Mm. And it didn't work out like that here, especially when we got independence and we became more Catholic. Then they expanded the definition of what a fallen woman was. So women who got pregnant outside of marriage, yes, absolutely. But it got really expanded. There's a case of a girl taken from Blackpool because she had a boyfriend, and she was still a virgin, but she had a boyfriend, and her three younger sisters as well, all put up to the Good Shepherds by the local parish priest. Their mother died, and the parish priest basically accused the father of not keeping them under control because the 16-year-old girl had a boyfriend, and they were put up to the laundry, all four of them. And so it started to get expanding into, one of my favourites was love of dress. There were girls in there for having a love of dress. So they like nice clothes and to look nice. Vanity was considered a really bad trait in women and girls at the time, especially poor women and girls. And poor women and girls were easier targets because, you know, if your family had any power, they could stop this happening to you.
But, and power was money back then.
Yeah, yeah. But if they didn't, then that was that, you know, you were gone. And lots of people were taken by the Legion of Mary, the parish priest, school teachers. Mm. Some girls would report that they were being molested, and then they'd be taken as if that was the solution to the problem. We'll put her in there. Yeah, she's not being molested anymore. Now she's literally a slave. So, you know, or a slave laborer. She wasn't property, but she wasn't being paid either. So there was all of these layers of what a fallen woman is. And eventually it got to the point where industrial school girls whose mothers had them when they weren't married were then considered fallen as well. So you were fallen by birthright. So you went straight from the industrial school into the laundry.
And
without ever seeing the outside world.
Was there an age timeline? And you went in there and you're six. Was there such a thing that when you get to a certain age, you're free, or have they can hold on to you for as long as they actually want?
If you were sentenced to an industrial school, you'd be sentenced till you were about 16, and you were kind of considered an adult in at least in the older times by the time you were 16, you know. So usually you were sentenced till you were 16. But if no one was going to come looking for you, and if you escaped and the guards brought you back anyway, there was no system. It was arbitrary detention. There was no court system that necessarily sentenced you. There were a few women sentenced for things like concealment of birth, which meant that they had a baby in a shed kind of thing. And they'd hid their pregnancy, and maybe the baby was born not alive, or different things like that. So then it would extend sometimes to infanticide. So infanticide is killing off your infant child. So there were a handful of women sentenced on those terms. But I know of one case of a woman who was sentenced on those terms, and she did something like 60 years and died in there and is buried up there.
Well, I think, like, if you're in institutions and you're a baby or a child, and then it comes to 16, 18, they say there's an element of Stockholm syndrome as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, it's all, you know. Yeah. They're your carers. They're the only people that's going to provide for you.
It's like prisoners in America have spent 14, 50 years. A lot of them, when they get out, they can't settle into society because it's so different. A lot of them take their own lives.
This is it. And I find that the industrial school girls were fairly, you know, there was fairly heavy-handed training by the nuns in cleaning and cooking and stuff. So they will be working in hospitals as cleaners and stuff like that. And they'll keep a very clean home. But the boys were taught completely different stuff. So sadly, you'll get a lot of industrial school men who don't know how to look after themselves, because the preparation of meals and things like that, the washing of your own clothes, that wasn't part of their lives. So they're sent out without any domestic skill. And then the girls are sent out with only domestic skill. So it was very, very gendered, feminism again, like, you know,
Jerome, you were getting involved in your activism around all this. Can you talk about the dynamic between mothers and children that have come from there?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you rather not?
No, I just think there's a...
Because I don't think people are aware of, like,
there's
it's
a
not
lot
so
of trauma.
Straightforward, like.
No, there's a lot of trauma. So, like, you could have someone who was in the industrial school, who was also in a Magdalen laundry, who when you speak to her and you learn her story, you'll actually find out she was also born to a single mother. And you might this single mother is just the phrase. I don't mean anything by it. That when you begin to uncover her history, you'll find out her mother was 14.
She's probably raped by the grandfather or a relative or something like that.
Exactly. And you know, you have to think of Ireland at that time. We say, going back now to something like the 50s, the worst thing you could do was get pregnant as a girl. So it's not like many girls were out enjoying an active sex life at all. It was worse than getting cancer. Like, it was worse than coming home and telling your parents you were dying. And I think that carried true right through the 80s and into the 90s, because I saw it around Mayfield a lot. And I know myself, I thought it was the worst thing I could have done. Like, I was really afraid.
That fear is probably still instilled in a lot of women in their 40s and late 40s and 50s and 60s. It's still there,
I think so. And like, that's the thing. So you'll have these broken relationships where people will go and they'll try and reunite. But they're... So the adult child is looking for a mother, and the mother is somebody who's been broken by both losing their child, but also everything else the system has done to them. So they're not able. And the relationship isn't there. And I know of some really wonderful adoptees who are friends of mine who respect their mothers and their birth mothers, but the best they can hope for is to be their friend. It's broken. It's been lost.
Is there mothers out there that, let's go with that example you said, say there's a 14-year-old girl after being raped by a family member, she ends up in Besborough, the child is taken from her. 30 years later, right, she's 44 and the child is 30. The child is going looking for the mother. The mother has long since moved on, remarried, the husband knows nothing about her, she's got new kids, and all that stuff has been compartmentalised and put behind her.
Yeah.
And now there's this 30-year-old looking for her. She has the right not to be found.
I think so. And I think, look, it's a very controversial issue, and you're probably going to get comments now. We are one of the only groups that set up to speak for mothers, and a lot of them didn't consent to be mothers. So asking them for a relationship when they didn't consent to sex, to pregnancy or motherhood, is really asking them to face the worst trauma in their life.
Yeah.
In an unsafe and uncontrolled environment. I think if someone wants to go into a psychotherapist's office and do it professionally, I think it's a great thing to do. Yeah. And the healing is there. And your journey shows that. Some people can come through the worst hell and out the other side. And, you know, but doing it on Facebook through search angels and things like that, I think is really dangerous. And I don't think it's gone well for people. From the cases I know anecdotally. Also then, you sometimes have mothers who want to reestablish that relationship, but the person who they gave birth to is a different person. They were raised by a different family. They have a different life. And they don't know you.
We dropping a time bomb up on top of that person's laps, and they mightn't be able for that grief, the trauma of realising where they actually came from, and the trauma that their biological parent went through, you know, inside in these homes and giving birth to them and whatever else led up to that woman getting pregnant or whatever. And imagine having a normal life and never having much trauma, you know, knowing that you're adopted, and then having to go through that, it might be very difficult.
Yeah, no, and I would say I agree with every adoptee and every person I know who's had an early life separation, that's a trauma in and of itself. But they're different traumas. You know, the trauma that the mother has is based in memory and psychology, and the trauma that the now adult baby has is based in the body. So I think, I don't know enough about it because I'm not a psychologist, but there's obviously problems there. And social workers have a method that they use now that seems to have begun to work for at least some people, and you begin with a letter. So, you know, you write your mom a letter, she writes you a letter, and you take it from there. And there might be letters exchanged over the course of 2 years before you ever meet.
Do you know if you were born in Bessborough and you don't know who your parents are?
Yeah.
Can you go and find them now?
No. The short answer is no. I mean, the government is moving legislation called the Adoption Information and Tracing Bill, where the intention is to make that information available. And it's your birth cert, but it's also your early life information. So if there's something on the file about who your father is, you will have a right to that as well. So they will have a right to the paperwork. But the problem is the paperwork is not always reflective of the true story. And it's often reflective of what the woman wanted to say, but also the nun's opinion. So,
yeah.
Like, the nun will just write down what she thinks happened. It doesn't mean it necessarily happened.
And have you got two sides there then where certain people affected want the records to be opened and certain people want it to stay, remain sealed?
I think there are some mothers who are worried, but at least in our group where there were some mothers who were worried, a conclusion was came to that they could have the information, but they couldn't have a relationship. So you can, you know, there's the mothers who are sympathetic to the idea that someone needs to know who they are, but they were also very frightened about the idea of them expecting to be their mother or have an open relationship with them. And often it is something like a husband who doesn't know, or children who don't know, you know, other children who don't know. And that's hard too for the adopted person because they have siblings out there.
I know, it's, you know, it's just so much trauma.
There is so much trauma.
Are we as a country, is this the limit of the stuff as the shit, right? All these homes and stuff like that. Is this the limit, or is there more that hasn't been spoken about yet? Is like, are we at the top of it?
I think there's a lot more.
Yeah.
I think Catherine's podcast with G was brilliant. She obviously got her feeling really comfortable. So good for you.
I hope you feel comfortable now.
I do. I'm an anxious person anyway. I overthink everything, but I do feel comfortable. But they, like, I'm friends with Catherine nearly 2 years now, and we're really good friends. We speak on the phone a lot, and she'll tell me something brand new every time we talk. And I'll be like, what? That happened? Like, for example, the time she told me that if you were caught looking at yourself, your reflection in a door or a mirror, you know, you'd be polishing something, they make you do the cleaning. So you're polishing away and you cast sight of your reflection, as I am in the TV over here. And they might notice you fix your hair, you get a slap for it. You're slapped for looking at yourself, you know.
Do you know what I think? Do you know the direct provisions at the moment? I think that's going to come out down the line. The trauma people are experiencing there.
Yeah.
Do you know, because there's women down there, they're involved in sex work because they have no other choice, because they're getting €19 a week. There's families living in rooms for 9 and 10 years. There's violence goes on, the food is terrible. Do you know, there's so much trauma. Being confined in, and they don't go on hunger strike just for the crack. Like,
no.
Is this where all the refugees are above?
They're waiting the refugee status, so they're asylum seekers. So while they're waiting for their application, they're stored in what's like a hotel. They're allowed out during the day to get €19 a week.
And a lot of these people know that are here, a lot of them will face a lot of difficulties where they came from. And
they'll be coming from areas where ISIS was chopping people's heads off, stuff like that. Like.
And is there any system, is there anything up there then? Like to help these people deal with the trauma, or any psychologist or psychotherapists in these places, like to help these people?
For following the direct provision Twitter accounts, I don't think there's anything. Nothing really. And they also spend
a very long
period of time in these places. Yeah, so like I've seen cases where somebody was born in Ireland and she was at a protest holding a sign in her school uniform, age 12. It's 12 years. Indirect provision, that was her, that's her family home, so that's her childhood, you know.
This is now what's going to come out down the line.
Is there many people inside in these communities then?
There's loads, and do you know what's the sickening thing about it? Do you know where they're housed? They're private enterprises. So let's say you own the facility, you're getting millions upon millions. You're making millions off their misery, basically. And then the catering companies are making, I mean, this is a whole business, isn't it? So then they're lobbying to perpetuate, to keep it going. You know,
it's
what
like
I mean?
The prisons in America.
Yeah, it's like same that. Thing. It's privatized, like, and everything, then it's heavily incentivized then by government, you know. Or take these in, we give you this contract worth so many millions every year. So then your business runs on the fact that we need people to stay
more
in here.
People, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, it's just a very fucked up system, but that's what's going to come out down the line. That'll be the next kind of scandal.
And your profit margin is where you can save money on these people's qualities of life. So, the food, you've seen the images of the food, no doubt. So there's people tweet some of the meals they get, and I mean, you wouldn't give it to the dog, like.
The last one I seen was two slices of white bread with a slice of tomato in the middle of it.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was the lunch, and I'm sure it was a pregnant woman as well posted it. But I wanted to get somebody on, and when the direct provision activist groups advised me against it because they could be targeted for hate.
Yeah.
Because they get a lot of hate.
Maybe somebody who's been granted status or who feels safe. I don't know, but yeah.
It's a really hard one.
But they are ending direct provision. There's a schedule to bring it to an end. To like basically, this system has to go.
Yeah. And slowly they're being allowed to work, although very restricted. And then there's sanctuary scholarships and UL, I believe, started it, and UCC and stuff like that. So it's just going to take a long time. But to bring it back to Besborough before we wrapped up that part of it. So there's people buried down there, babies buried down there, and they want to develop it for social housing.
Okay, so it's about a 60-acre estate of mostly fields with the institutional buildings in the middle. But back in the day, it was even bigger. So some of that is already gone. And the location of the children's burial ground had not been known for a long time because there was no markers. So if you go down to Besborough, near where what was called the maternity building, you can walk through these big black gates, and there's this kind of a nice garden with a gravel walk in the middle. And when you get to the end of it, there's a 19th century castle folly, a fake castle. And at the foot of the castle folly is the nuns' graveyard, and it's marked with black iron Celtic crosses, each of their names, individual graves, and a statue of, it's called the Risen Christ. So it's after he's come up the tomb and he's standing on top of the tomb and raising his hand to heaven. So they have all of that. And then just outside of that, there's a 1.3-acre field that has been identified as the children's burial ground for maps. And there was a developer who bought that land, and they actually wanted to build cheap apartments on it. So they weren't social housing, but they were like, you know, that kind of really high density apartments that people, the working poor rent, those kind of apartments with very little parking and, you know, that kind of thing. And really, really high density. And the development plan had always said, so the development plan is the city guide for what you build. It had always said that it would be sensitive development. So I was really surprised to see this monstrosity, in my own personal opinion, don't sue me, being dumped in there. And we were already looking for the children's burial ground. The Commission of an Investigation had failed to find it. The nuns claimed that they didn't know where the children were buried, and claimed that those who were old enough to remember didn't remember any children dying, even though there was quite a lot of reported deaths in certain sisters' time there. So we went looking, and I don't know, like, you might have encountered this with your partners, like, but don't tell an Ori woman she can't do something. And don't tell Catherine Coffee O'Brien she can't do something.
Yeah.
So we started looking at Ordnance Survey Ireland maps, and we found one that said children's burial ground, but it was what's called a 6-inch map. So it's quite a small map, and a lot of detail is squashed in on top, so you wouldn't necessarily get the right location. So we went looking for the 25-inch map, and they're the gold standard in mapping. And if two posh guys were going to sue each other about where the fence was or who owned that field, that would be the thing they'd use. They'd use a 25-inch map. So we were looking for that, and I was sending emails to Ordnance Survey Ireland and ringing them. And one day they answered the phone, and a guy said to me, we're looking. Everyone's looking throughout the building. You've caused a ruckus or something like that. No, he wasn't giving out to me. He was just a bit exasperated. So I said, okay, fair enough. I'll leave you to it. And I told our pro bono legal team, And not long after that, the barrister got a call from somebody in Ordnance Survey Ireland who had something to show him. So he went in, and one of the staff there had found the original 25-inch map, the hand-drawn one. And Children's Burial Ground was written on it with a big circle around it. And these guys were in the army, so they had a code for everything. So if there was an oak tree, you wrote oak, and if the tree was medium, you wrote M. So you'd O brackets M, and then a gravel walk would be G walk. If a fence was there, you marked it down. If a fence had been there and it had been taken away, you made sure it was removed from the map. Really highly detailed system of reporting. And it went through 7 layers of checking. So your boss would catch out if you made a mistake, basically. Oh, yeah. And they used to dock them a day's pay if they got a mistake. So they took the mistakes really serious.
Yeah.
But guys who did this were super nerds. They loved it. You know, they loved getting it right and accurate. So the person who drawn the big circle around it was, because there was no fence, there was no nothing. There was nothing to indicate how far out into that field the children were buried. But that is the information he had on the ground in January 1950, and he would have had to get the nun to sign off on that. And a lot of people don't trust nuns. I don't trust them either, but I trust the Ordnance Survey mapper who made sure that the information he was regarding is accurate. And so she would have had to sign that. It would have had to go in a big ledger as well. So when the map evidence was explained to us by the guy in Ordnance Survey who really stood over it, we said, okay, you know, and we accepted it because it was the best evidence. It seemed to line up with some of the stories we had. Some women remembered men walking in that direction with babies' bodies or shovels or things like that. And there was no conceivable reason for him to write down Children's Burial Ground if there wasn't a Children's Burial Ground.
Gain from that, like.
Yeah, yeah. But we had to defend that over 3 days to an oral hearing of On Board Planola. And that mapping expert was on the stand for 6 hours. I've seen murder trials on TV, you know, dramatised stuff that were this over the top.
And what was the net result of it?
So they lost their case, and we won, and they can't build there. Thank you.
Who would have been the defence? Who's defending? Was it the city or was it the nuns?
No, they hired so they were a private company who bought the land off the nuns. So they hired some of the best, some of the most expensive legal people in the city.
Oh, they weren't belong to the church or anything like
that? No, the church had sold it on. Now, there was any connection there, I'll never know.
I thought they just didn't want...
They'd sold on that bit. There's another bit that has a question mark on it. It's the only part the nuns kept, and it's where they're buried. Now, the nuns never buried any of the industrial school, mother and baby home, Magdalen Laundry people in with their own. But there's a chance they're nearby. But that field is next to it anyway. So maybe some of the children who are in the big field are also in the area near where the nuns are buried. But it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's all the one circle. There just happens to be a fence through it.
They're not allowed to develop that land now.
They have few options. The legal team explained they've very few options, and none of them would work out very well for them. So ideally, they'd redesign it. Or, we've asked the state to buy it, to at least buy the children's burial ground section, which is about 1.36 acres. And whether they buy it by consent, that the current landowner sells it to them, or they have to CPO it, whatever, you know. But, I mean, it's like talking to a brick wall. There is no communication from those developers.
Do you think families, the victims involved, would be happy for part of it to be developed if there was acknowledgement that there was babies there and there was remembrance put in?
That's what they told me. And they're women whose babies actually died there.
That seems fair enough, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what though, James? I suppose there's an ethical and moral kind of side of it as well for these developers to have, like, this is the burial ground of a load of babies, you know, that were brought in.
Who the fuck wants to go in and dig up that?
Who still wants to build a lot of apartments and ground, even to excavate into the ground, and you're coming across all these small little
But you know, if you have
it, well, it just doesn't make sense.
I mean, the majority of the infants of the estimated 800 and say around 850 plus stillborn infants, the majority of them died before 1950. So you're talking about bones that are quite old, and again, trigger warning to absolutely everybody and anyone who's lost a child or anything like that. Infant bones are poorly mineralized, so they're not hard. You know, the way child's bones grow in,
yeah.
The way adult's bones, and the skull is infused, so it has to grow together. So they actually decay at a much more rapid rate than adult bones. Now, I'm not saying they wouldn't find them. If they went looking, they would obviously find some evidence of infant remains. But it's not going to be pristine, preserved, nice graves. The field they buried them in was a pasture land where cows grazed.
Yeah.
So you're talking, cows are about a ton in weight over it. So,
it's not so straightforward. Yeah, like.
It's not so straightforward, unfortunately. And I wish it was, but it isn't. Yeah. And
well, look, we send our regards and to all the victims involved, mothers, babies, children, everybody that was involved, and the survivors and the advocates that still campaign today as well. Fair play to everybody. And recently there was an announcement around the redress, 800 million amongst 34 grand, amongst 34,000 people, which works out between 10 to 20,000 each, which is not a lot of money. But maybe looked at there'll be more news than that. I'm going to bring the story back to you.
Okay.
Before we wrap up.
Yeah.
So you were telling us before that you have an autoimmune condition, which means you have chronic pain.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was doing my master's, I was in a very small car accident, and it really was tiny. It shouldn't have been bad.
It was a small accident or a small car?
Small car accident in a small car.
Oh.
Way to put it. Yeah. I like that.
We were rear-ended, and I had my arm up on the door, and my elbow was kind of pressed between the door and the bone itself. And it's called a golfer's elbow, and it's inflammation of the joint. But a few months later, a good bit later, I got two things happened. I got a virus that was going around in the community, and it led to nerve pain. And the other thing that was happening was I was having physiotherapy, and the ultrasound machine was turned up quite high, and I felt I got a kind of a shock off it.
Mm.
So I started getting nerve pain. And if you've ever had a toothache, it's like having a toothache forever, you know, and
how do you manage that?
Well, I didn't manage it.
Affect your mental health?
Well, I went on the drug Lyrica, which was for nerve pain and things like that, nerve damage. And it did affect my mental health. And I think Lyrica had a part to play in it. It wasn't right for me. But also, why didn't I heal? Why did my body not heal? Why do other people's bodies heal and mine didn't heal? So that bothered me. The nerve pain would drive you insane out of any other pain. You know, I laugh in the face now of muscular pain, like, whatever, it's not nerve pain. But the nerve pain would drive you mad. So I tried Lyrica. I had to get off it. I wasn't happy with how it was affecting me. And I also did go, I went into one of those counselling courses there. So they're like, if you're on medical card and you ask your GP for counselling, you get 8 weeks. And
you do, yeah.
Yeah, so I went to that as well. And just began to explore things. But I in the end, I found that meditation was my thing. And that even my way of thinking was a big part of why the pain was worse and why it would get worse. And it's stress exacerbated. And, you know, if you don't look after yourself, that makes sense, that if you're overworking your body, that is going to hurt, you know. But I used body scan meditation to really watch the nerve pain. And I started to notice there was gaps between the pain, which I never thought there was. So then I started to kind of go, oh, the gaps between the pain are the place I want to live, you know.
Yeah.
So I tried to lengthen the gaps, and I tried to dial it down in the same way that I thought my brain had dialed it up. So the nerve pain hurt, and then you're looking at your arm, you're like, it hurts so much, it hurts so much. And it sort of amplifies it and it makes it louder. And so I tried to do the same thing in reverse, and it wasn't easy. and it took a long time. And some days I have nerve pain. I don't really have it in my arm anymore, but I still get it in my hip and my leg, and sometimes in my neck. But the fear of it being forever, I found, was a big part of it, and fear in general was a big part of it. And yeah, I meditated. And
how is it today, for example?
My sciatica, so I have sciatica, or it's what my physio calls sciatica anyway. My lower back hurts on the left side. It's fine today. If I spend a day with the women listening to trauma stories, I find I'm absolutely shattered that night. Mm. So I just do things like, I make rules for myself, like no sad stories after 8 p.m. Mm. Yeah, it's a big one.
No tonalities before 6.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't do this at like 11 o'clock at night and get into the bed, because I'd just be lying there wired thinking.
Do you know what's standing out for me is your body and your energy is healing and sitting with the pain in a normal day, and you're able, when you're listening to a sad story, your energy can get sucked from you too, and it might take that bit of energy from you, and the pain that's been soothed by the extra energy that's been taken for you, it might be bringing the pain up a little bit more. But you know what the key is. You know what the key is. Meditation is the key to surrender and acceptance.
It is.
And it's about, like, I had a friend who had tetanus. If anybody knows what tetanus is, it's a consistent ringing in the ear. Doesn't stop, right? And some people go mad over it. Mm. Literally, it's renowned in the construction industry because it can go hammer on a drill, it's constant going, you know.
I gave it to myself from clenching my jaw too
much. Yeah, yeah. And
like that.
We used to be chatting about it, and he was meditating on it, and he just grew to accept that this is part of who he is today.
Yeah.
And it stopped completely. It's still there.
Yeah.
But it's just like your taste buds are there. It's the same thing. And he've a great life. Nothing has changed. His life is like it was before. But it's about that, gaining that acceptance around it and surrendering into it when it comes. It's like if you're having a bad day, when I'm having a bad day, I use it, because I know that there's healing in it, and I know that if you're having a bad day, sit into it, accept it, and just feel whatever's going on for you. And it's the pain you said a while ago. Oh, the pain! This thing is going to be here forever. A bad day could do the same things in your head. If you're having a bad day and you're feeling something in your body and you don't like it, you know, your head will tell you, "Fucking hell, I'm going to have to. I was like this before. When is this never going to stop?" But like, I have this ingrained voice in my head as well that says, tomorrow will be different.
Yeah.
I have that. I kept saying, tomorrow will be different. It'll be fine. There's no 2 days the same.
Mine is a Buddhist tale called This Too Shall Pass. So, do you know that one?
I do. Yeah. I know it well.
Yeah. It's just remembering that whatever it is, it'll pass. And the Buddhists are really funny about it, because they're like, even if you have it for the rest of your life, you'll die eventually and then it'll pass, you know. And I like that kind of humour.
Yeah.
And pain is also a great way to become conscious without no judgment. So when you start judging your pain, you're in big trouble.
Yeah. And you know, I had to go through all that. I hear a lot of people say they can't meditate.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like I was good at it at the start.
But you get good at it, just like anything else.
Like driving.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you kind of need a muscle memory for it. And then as well, you'll have a bad day where you're terrible at it. Same with driving.
Yeah.
You know, you just will. Like,
you know what? I learned this at the beginning of my own journey, that there's, we were saying you could have a bad meditation or whatever, but I learned that there's probably no such thing as a bad meditation. What it is really is you judging the meditation.
Yeah.
Your head might be all over the place where it wasn't yesterday. Yeah. But what that does as well, it tells you what kind of state of being you're in that day, especially in the morning. And if it's constant, you know then that you're going to have a busy mind for that day.
Yeah.
And it's really time to really sit with it and just understand it. And that's how I got to know myself, you know. Yeah. It took me a long time to have that understanding and that acceptance.
The other thing is, that I learned from my reading and reflecting and maybe a bit from counselling is, as Irish people, we kind of, you know, we make heroes out of people who suffer. So, you know, especially women, suffer, and you know, the Virgin Mary complex, like it's suffering is a virtue, and aren't you great now, you know, and that kind of crap that I had to get over, you know, and divorce my thinking from and just wake up from. And another thing, God, is I thought meditation was focus. And then one day a Buddhist monk who was Western explained in a YouTube podcast that Westerners think it's focus. It's not, it's stillness.
It's being.
Be still. Yeah. Mm. It's not concentrate. Because if I concentrate, I'm giving it everything. Yeah. You know, that's not a good idea for it's meditation.
Being, being with what is, being with whatever is going on for you at that present moment without any judgment, and being compassionate to yourself.
Mm.
You know, if your mind goes off for a second or two back into something else in the past or in the future or something you may have to do later on in that evening, it's about surrendering straight into that and bringing it back into the moment, the breath, the body scan. Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
And just consistently doing that, and you'll integrate that into your everyday life. Where shit does come up for you, that stillness will come because you'll have to building that awareness in meditation by consistently bringing it back with compassion.
Yeah.
And you have that compassion innate. No, it's built into you. So every time you go off, gone again, bring it back. Go back into the breath and just be nice to yourself.
Yeah.
And whatever that ruminating negative critic was going on in your mind, and it may have left some form of negative feeling in your body, it's about just feeling it, and it's gone in seconds. Sometimes it may take a minute, 2 minutes, and it's gone. And that's what meditation is about. It's about, that release and learning about your body. And it works. And it does work.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Do you want to close the podcast for us by reading the quote on the wall?
The Buddha was asked, "What have you gained from meditation?" He replied, "Nothing." However, the Buddha said, "Let me tell you what I have lost. Anger, anxiety, depression, insecurity, fear of old age and death."
Thank you. You've been a great guest.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
See you next week, lads.
Thanks, everyone.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.